Vicar Alf, real one. Where were you born, please?
In southeast London, Brockley.
Which year was this?
It was in 1922.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Brockley?
Yes, I did.
Which school did you go to there?
I went to, first of all, Mantle Road, infants and juniors, and then to Brockley Central School, one of the London Central Schools.
How old were you when you finished there?
I was 17.
So war had started, or just about to start?
Just about to. Mm.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I did.
How did you feel about that?
We were quite political at Brockley Central School, and we were all against this. We felt that fascism had to be stopped.
So you
even going back to the Spanish War, we turned out, you know, to demonstrate. It was a... I think the title of the demonstration was Milk for Spain or something, if I remember rightly.
So you supported the war declaration?
Yes. I thought it was a long time coming.
Had you been a member of a political organisation pre-war?
No, shortly after.
What did you join?
I joined an organisation called Federal Union.
What was that?
Well, the idea was that... Europe should combine against fascism. Strangely enough, very soon after joining, the war had started, and I had a visit from a gentleman from the police who wanted to know all about it. How they found out this, I don't know.
What was the background to this organisation?
Well, just as it said, Federal Union, and working towards what really, I suppose, is the European Union now.
What kind of membership did that have?
Mostly young, I think. I remember a blind man turned up once, and he'd come quite a long distance, and he'd got my address. I was a sort of secretary. It was a group of quite interested people, but not very many, and mostly young.
So you were the secretary of a branch of the Federal Union?
Yes, I was.
What was the name of that branch?
Well, I can't remember now. I should think South East London. I don't know.
Not Brockley?
I don't think so, no. It was sort of cast wider afield than that.
Who'd started the organisation?
I can't remember now. I didn't stay too long because the war came, and certainly South East London quickly became embroiled, and all thoughts of Federal Union went. Although, strangely enough, Churchill, after Dunkirk, offered such a union to the French. And there were notices up, you know, on lampposts, you know. And
what did the notices say?
Well, it said something about message à tous les Français, it started, I remember, and just sort of offering this union with France.
Did the Federal Union support that?
Well, they must have done, but I don't remember, you know, just... it coming up at a meeting. Probably I'd, you know, drifted out of it by then. I think it virtually collapsed with the war, you know.
What kind of activities did the Federal Union have?
Well, merely meetings and propaganda.
What form did the propaganda take?
Well, just leaflets of, I would say, a fairly innocent and benign nature, nothing revolutionary, just putting forward this suggestion and... probably the war concentrated minds that at the end of the war this might be a very good thing to stop further European war.
Did the propaganda that you conducted arouse much interest?
Only among a certain section. The war clouds were looming, and I think people's minds were filled with that, not taking up a union with other European countries.
Did the war affect you at first?
Not the phony war, as it was so called. The real war started in 1940, and I can remember the war clouds were looming to such an extent that we had all the bits for an Anderson shelter, but we hadn't had it put up at the time it arrived, and we decided we must get on and do it ourselves, and so the family became involved in putting up this Anderson's shelter, when the first siren went, the war declaration came, and then immediately afterwards a siren sounded. There was supposed to have been an unidentified aircraft in the Thames estuary. Whether it was that or just to wake everybody up, I don't know.
Were you in any bombing of England by the German Air Force?
Once the real war had started, most definitely. This was mostly when I was in the local defence volunteers.
Can you tell me about your LDV membership, please?
Yes, this was the, you know, pre-Home Guard. I was probably something like Private Pike in those days, you know, in Dad's army. And anyway, I joined full of enthusiasm. And we first of all guarded an RAF balloon barrage station in southeast London, and then a railway station on Oroke Park, quite a small little station. I don't really know what tactical advantages it would have been to the Germans, but anyway, we guarded it. We had old Canadian Ross rifles from the First World War, no ammunition, no bayonets, and that was our weapon. I suppose we were intended to swing it if we were in any way challenged.
Was it called the Broccoli Local Defence Volunteer?
There again, I can't remember its title, if it even ever had one. It was called locally, and somebody had been appointed as sergeant, and he at that stage ran things. And after these two guard places that we had to guard, the real war started with the dock raid on London, and it was in the afternoon, and I was called out, and I was placed in Broccoli at the confluence of Enwell Road and Vesta Road, and I was told to remain there at my post because there was an unexploded bomb, and I had to make quite sure that no traffic entered Vesta Road, because somewhere further on in Vesta Road, this unexploded bomb had fallen, and they were afraid that anybody passing, you know, might suffer the consequences. So I stayed at my post, and darkness fell. I'd been told, by the way, I would be relieved in some small number of hours, probably three, something like that. But time went on, and the bombers droned over, and bombs fell, and I find myself diving behind a garden wall, and still totally alone. Everybody had gone for cover. There was no traffic whatsoever. And still the raids on the docks went on, and it really got quite scary there. And finally, I think it was about 2 or 3 in the morning, an old police sergeant came up on a bicycle, and he said, "What are you doing there?" And I said, "I'm guarding here because there's an unexploded bomb." He said, "You silly young bugger, get home at once and get undercover." And I needed no second invitation. I was away and got into the Anderson shelter at home.
Any other memories of the bombing?
Well, quite a few. I mean, it became commonplace after that. We had what was said to have been an aerial mine. Fell on the lower part of Warbutton Road. It was actually a hill, quite a steep hill. And it demolished all of the houses in the lower part of the road. And ours was very severely damaged. All the windows and window frames were blown in and ceilings down. And it meant the house was, for all practical means, uninhabitable. And so the family broke up.
What was your exact address?
It was 42 Warbutton Road, Broccoli.
How frightening was the Blitz for you?
Very frightening when it started, but one got used to it after a bit, and you had to lead your life and do your job. And that really led on to the second part, my leaving the LDV. I worked for a firm in London, which is now Finer Petroleum Company. Those days it was Cities Service Petroleum Company, I remember. And the managing director decided that as most of his staff could get to where he lived at Shepperton, that it would be better if the accounts department, where I worked, should be transferred to Shepperton. This left me with a bit of a problem. I, living in South East London, wouldn't have found it at all easy, and he suggested it would be a very good idea if I went to live during the week at Shepperton. And he also used the company funds to buy a motorbike, and I was to have the use of this motorbike to provide liaison with the accounts office in London if things should get too bad there and normal lines of communication broke down. So I had the pleasure of riding this motorbike. I knew theoretically how to ride a motorbike, but I'd never had any experience. But there was a path round his garden that, you know, was quite adequate for that, and I learned to ride the motorbike. And of course, there were raids in that area too, but not in the concentrated way that they were in London. There was a raid, for instance, on Weybridge Vicar's Works. And I think possibly one day I got the tail end of that because the siren sounded and there was activity that could be heard, but there was overcast. And I went into the garden to see if I could see anything. And suddenly there was a burst of machine gun fire and bullets spattered down, and one went into the drive just in front of me. And I was actually able to dig it out, and I gave it to my mum as a souvenir, and she put it in her purse. But of course, what happened after that, my mum died shortly after the war, and I never retrieved it.
Any other incidents you remember from the Blitz period?
Well, only we lost our home. Most of the family went to Purley, and my mother and one sister who'd suffered badly. Oh yes, one incident happened that I should recount first, and that was we were in the Anderson shelter at one stage. The raid had started, and suddenly Head and Shoulders appeared in the opening, and it was a policeman, and he gave us the very worrying news that my sister, who was a chief operator in the telephone service, had been in the exchange when it had received a direct hit, and she'd been taken to hospital, but he didn't know her condition, so we felt we ought to go at once and find out. So we left during the Blitz. She was still quite bad, as you can imagine, and went to the hospital. My sister was badly concussed, and she had a perforated eardrum and superficial cuts and bruises, but fortunately, apart from that, she survived, and we were given this news, but we only just got a glimpse of her, and then we told, you know, we could come back tomorrow. So we went back the next day, and she'd gone. It was the policy then to remove all the patients in the mental hospitals around London and turn them into emergency hospitals for the casualties, and she'd been taken to Epsom, to the Horton Emergency Hospital, as it was called then. And I remember we went to see her at the weekends at Epsom, and I remember feeling with my family, you know, how wonderful it was to get a bit of relief from the atmosphere of South East London. And I remember we went to the pub hotel there called the Spread Eagle, and it all seemed so civilised and calm, you know, after what we'd been experiencing.
Whereabouts was this telephone exchange?
In the Old Kent Road.
Did your sister make a complete recovery?
Apart from the perforated eardrum, she did, yes.
How did public morale stand up to the bombing?
Well, pretty well, I think. Certainly in our part of London. I've read reports afterwards that it wasn't so in parts of East London. They probably suffered worse than South East London, but certainly, you know, I think there was in Warburton Road, it was mostly stiff upper lips and chins out, you know.
Did you at that time think the Germans might win the war?
Not really, no. We were prepared for them in our amateurish way for them coming, and I remember, you know, the motto was, if you've got to die, take one of them with you, you know.
What are your next memories in the war?
Well, I was in the middle of saying, you know, about my mother and sister going down to Ilfracombe. And I remember one Christmas, my father and I went down there to spend with my mother and sister, but he had to get back a bit earlier than I did, and I stayed a bit longer over the Christmas. And while I was down there, another fierce raid took place over southeast London. And I know my father, you know, had quite near missing that incident. I felt it was so hard that he went back to get that, and I hadn't. I should mention, by the way, that he had volunteered for the army in the First World War and was put in the Grenadier Guards and had really seen war, not as I ever saw it.
Was the war affecting Ilfracombe very much?
No.
And then?
Well, I then felt at that stage when I was at Shepperton, I felt that it was time that I volunteered for the RAF. I had quite a lot of support from one of the other directors, you know, to I was in the accounts department, and as others had got called up, I'd moved up the ladder quite a lot. But he sort of backed my case that it was okay for me to volunteer, and you know, rather than be called up, as all the others had, I was the sort of first volunteer. And I volunteered for the Air Force, and then just trained others, and among them was the girl who was to become my wife eventually. After years had passed, and it was after the war.
Why did you decide to go in for the RAF?
I'd always been interested in flying, and I went to the Biggin Hill Air Display as a boy. We rode there on our bikes from Propley, you know, and I remember my father was going to take me to Sir Alan Cobham's Air Circus, and they had short flights there, and I was to be given a short flight. But unfortunately, it never came off. I was ill at the time.
Where did you first train in the RAF?
Well, thereby hangs a tale as well. I volunteered for air crew, and I went to Western Supermare Air Crew Selection Board. This was just before the date, 1941. And things went well at first. I had to do an educational test, and I'd done quite well at Broccoli Central School. I'd got my school certificate, and I'd also got the London Chamber of Commerce certificate. And so this stood me in good stead, I think, with the Air Crew Selection Board, and also the exam, the little exam I'd done for them as well. And they also liked London Central Schools. I remember one of them saying, oh, we've had some good material from London Central Schools, and that put me quite at my ease, and things were going splendidly. But then they gave me not the ordinary vision test. I'd passed that. This was the colour vision test. And I know I was quite amazed what they produced for this. It was a book with lots of pages of what at first sight just looked like coloured dots. But according to whether your colour vision was safe or unsafe, you could read the figures or letters. I think there were figures. I don't remember any letters that I had at any rate. You turned the pages and you had to say what you saw. And at the end of it, they just shook their heads and said, sorry, your colour vision defective unsafe. Apparently you can be colour vision defective safe, but I was unsafe. And I said, surely if I fly in a bomber, for all those other members of the crew can look out for any light signals. And, oh no, you know, you might be the only one to see it. And so that was the end of my, I thought it was, the end of my flying career. So I went into the RAF as ground staff. And in the very early days, I was called up before a couple of officers, and they said, there's something you ought to be very interested in, because we think from what we know of you that it would suit you very well, and that's to train as a wireless radar mechanic. I may have been called a radio radar mechanic, wireless radar mechanic, yes. And that meant that I had to go to Leicester College of Technology in an RAF uniform, and there with, I think, about 30 others, we formed a little group to study the basic elements of radio. And we're still under RAF discipline, and I remember we used to have to turn out for runs with a corporal PTI who was in charge of us for all administration purposes. And we used to have to strip down just to singlets and shorts, and we still wore our short RAF socks and big boots. And we ran as a squad round Leicester, and at that time there were lots of young women employed in the factories and mills in Leicester, and they used to look at us as we ran past and make, you know, embarrassing comments. But the terrible thing was, if you couldn't keep up with the rest and had to walk, and they left you far behind, and you still had to suffer these comments from the girls when you were alone. Fortunately, that didn't happen to me. At all costs, I kept up with the rest. From there, I went to Yatesbury, to, I think it was number 2 radar school. I'd been lucky to go there. It was only the top section that went for training as a radar mechanic. And I learnt actually afterwards that I should have had sound colour vision for some reason to be a radar mechanic, but nobody ever checked on it, and at a later stage it was lucky they didn't. Anyway, the radar course was most interesting, and I remember that A.C. Clark was there. He was a corporal instructor. Do you remember A.C. Clark, who he and Spielberg produced that film, 2000, what was it? Do you remember the name of the film?
2001?
2001 it must have been, yeah. But A.C. Clark used to write on Space Matters. He's quite a visionary, really. And even at that stage at Yatesbury, he was very, very interested. And I remember he used to digress, and he told us about jet fighters. They had one at Cranwell where he'd been, and he told us about this jet fighter, you know, that was going to make all the difference to war in the air. And of course for us it was Whittle and the Meteor that he was talking about.
This is not Arthur C. Clarke, is it? Who writes?
Yeah, A.C. Clarke.
Arthur C. Clarke,
yeah.
What capacity, was he one of the trainees?
He was a corporal instructor, yeah.
What was his character at that time?
Very keen, very ebullient, you know, always ready to, as I say, to digress and talk about other things connected with aircraft and space and radar and navigation and so on.
Did he befriend you?
Not particularly, no.
Any other memories from this period of training?
Yeah, it's free. Something quite inconsequential. I had a friend there on the radar course, Dave, and we used to go home for leave sometimes at the weekend from Yatesbury. And he came back, and he was a convinced Republican, was Dave, but he had changed his view a bit, because he was hoofing it along the road back to Yatesbury when an old-fashioned upright Rolls-Royce came along and stopped, and he was invited to get in, and it was Queen Mary. And she had, you know, somebody with her to look after her, and a driver. And she was able to chat with him in the back, and while they took him back to Yatesbury. And she was so charming that he really felt the royal family had something that he'd missed before.
She was the widow of George V, was she?
That's right, yes.
Where did you go to next?
When I left Gatesbury, I was posted to Worth Matravers, which is near Swanage.
Had you now qualified as a mechanic?
I'd qualified as a mechanic.
What had you thought about the quality of the training that you got?
Very good. Very good, both at Leicester College of Technology and at Yatesbury. And it was a 6 months course. It was extended later, and the RAF put out an order that radar mechanics shouldn't fly on operations, because they often did, because their training took much longer than any member of air crew. And that, you know, affected something I'll mention at a later stage.
What was your job to be at Worth Matravers?
It was what it was called, a CH station, chain home, the old original radar stations, you know, from directly on from Watson Watt. And it all started at Bordsea, I believe, on the east coast. And this one had 360-foot towers, transmission towers, and 240-foot receiving towers. And going up those towers to, you know, do inspections and things like that was largely left to the volunteers, it seemed to me. And I was always willing to do this, and so I had quite a bit of experience going up these towers and checking feeder lines and things of that sort. And while we were there at Worth Matravers, there were raids, and I remember on one occasion another mechanic, myself, we had a mechanic in each block, in the transmitter block and the receiver block, and we had a raid, and we lost our feeder lines. But there were alternative arrays. There were four masts, you see, and four receiving towers as well. So you could just switch over to sort of standby arrays, and this is what we did. I was at the transmitter end, and he was at the receiver end, and we just went through the drill and changed over and thought no more about it. And I was rather surprised at a later stage when I was posted overseas. One of the others wrote and said the sergeant mechanic who was on duty at that time had got a mention for this, you know, his station working, well, I don't know what you call it really, efficiently, as they should do. I remember on one occasion, we were billeted in Swanage. We used to travel out to Worth Matravers, and we also had a little mobile. They were smaller towers. The CH mobile towers, I think, were probably 120 feet wooden towers. And we used to go there and make sure everything was working there if the main station should, you know, be inoperative. Besides that, there was a CHL there, and I remember on one occasion, CHL is the low-flying radar. On one occasion, there was a low-flying raid, and which was below the CH possibility of getting, but the CHL should have picked it up, but they never did. Possibly the aircraft were, you know, just skimming on the top of the sea, I don't know. But anyway, there was damage in Swanage, and the CHL personnel were rather red-faced when they came back a watch, you know, to witness what had happened without their getting a sighting on it. It was also our job there as a mechanic, as duty mechanic, to, if there was a low-flying raid, to run up onto there was a little observation sandbag place on top of the roof where the gear was. And there was a Lewis gun. My dad had told me about Lewis guns from the First World War, and we were expected to loose off a few rounds if we could. I remember once I raced up in these circumstances, the time, you know, I got up there, they were in and out, you know, not a chance. And I think Lewis guns were fairly unreliable anyway, so I don't think it made much of an armament. It felt good to have a Lewis gun up there that one could fire.
How efficient did you feel radar was at that time?
Oh, pretty efficient. The operators had got very skilled indeed. Very often there were echoes from, you know, other things, hills and mountains. I mean, this was particularly noticeable.